Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Otra vez en el 2 para 1. Ante McNeil, la pelota para Fabio Vieira. Arma la pierna al portugués, no tiene espacio para el disparo. Tiene que tocar para Zinchenko. Reformula el Arsenal. Uy, qué bien lo ha hecho para Bukayo. ¡Saca el balón de
¡Qué
Gonzalo!
Golazo!
¡Qué golazo! ¡Qué golazo! ¡Qué golazo! ¡Leandro Trossard!
Is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunner Blog. James, after what seems like a long time, even though it hasn't really been, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you, Andrew. And it's a long time in the world of Arsenal,
yeah,
I guess.
It is.
But a sweet relief.
For sure. You are you're in Mallorca, so may I just say g'day, mate? Because Mallorca, as we know, is the Brisbane of Spain.
Absolutely. I am in rainy Mallorca this morning, but still having a lovely time. I'm here with lots of family and visiting other family. So I have to pretend that that is the real reason I'm here and not the fact that I was hoping for some nice sunny weather, which Jim, hasn't yet materialized.
I'm looking out my window here, right? Looking out my window in Dublin. Blue sky, birds are singing. It's not exactly beach weather, but the rain has stopped.
Should have visited the Irish family, not the Spanish family.
That's
I made a key error there.
Anyway, all is good at your end. All is good at this end. And all is good again in terms of Arsenal. So let me just say from the start here, before somebody takes me to task for today's theme music, normally I'll make a jingle from the commentary. I downloaded the game, the Spanish game, or Spanish commentary. The guy doing the commentary did the thing that I did. It sounded like he was talking into the backside of the microphone. I don't know how you do that with a commentary mic, because those are the ones that you hold up to your mouth.
Yeah. And also, surely at some point during the 90 minutes, someone's going to tell him.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But I had to listen to the commentary for the guy. He sounds like he's sort of back here when he's talking. And then his co-commentator is like, you know, right in here. And I thought that was a bit strange. So I had to use some Leandro Trossard theme music from earlier in the season for, I think it was a goal he scored against Everton.
Okay.
So that's it. So it's a Trossard theme tune, but it's not the goal that he scored on Saturday night. But, like, is anyone going to be that picky?
I don't know. Good on you for coming clean, though. We all admire your honesty.
Listen,
in the circumstances.
Communication and transparency, I'm all about that.
That is a big part of the Arse Blog philosophy.
Yes, we're like the opposite of PGMOL in that sense.
I hope so.
Oh, so, Molyneux, Saturday evening. Arsenal go into the game on the back of defeat in the Champions League to Bayern, defeat the previous weekend to Aston Villa. I'm not alone, and I'm sure you shared some concerns, reservations about not necessarily our ability to have a go, but our ability physically maybe to respond to two very difficult games, travel in midweek, and the energy-sapping impact that going out of the Champions League in a very you know, tight tie over two legs can have on the players. And, you know, we talk about physical fatigue, and I'm sure we'll get on to that, but there's also mental fatigue, and you can feel a lot more tired when you lose a couple of games. So, you know, what were you thinking pre-game here? Were you hopeful? Were you sort of like, you know, all things going well, we could win this game, but we've got to sort of pick ourselves up and dust ourselves down?
No, I sat down to watch the game in a black suit. I thought I was coming to the funeral for our season, honestly. Sort of solemnly, you know, processed into the living room, took my seat on the couch and waited for the worst to unfold. I think, like you said, defeats are tiring. They take it out of you, not just players, but fans a little bit as well. And there was just something about an away fixture, Saturday night, Molineux crowd are going to be up for it. I have to completely hold my hands up and say I feared the worst.
Okay. I mean, I get it. You know, it's easy when things are going well to see how everything in the garden is going to be rosy. And when things don't go well, it's difficult to see the wood for the trees, if I'm not mixing my metaphors up a little bit too much here. But, you know, like you, I had some concerns as well. And I think when I reflect on the game and when I reflect on how it went, I think the fear we had going into it and the fact that this was a 1-0 game for most of the second half does slightly inform your overall view. But when you look at it, really, it was quite a dominant performance from Arsenal in terms of attacking, in terms of chances, in terms of shots, in terms of, you know, what David Raya had to do versus his opposite number. But I think that sort of low-level fear / anxiety that was coursing through everybody as they sat down to watch this game, if this happens in September, we're probably talking about, well, that's a pretty solid professional away performance. But given the time of the season, given the context of the game, and given what's at stake right now, it felt a little bit different from the way it actually played out.
Maybe so. That seems to have been sort of the narrative around it. I have to say that from quite early in the game, I was really pleasantly surprised by Arsenal's performance and how sharp we looked in some respects. And I remember in the 87th minute, I think it was only 1-0 at the time, and Alan Smith on commentary said something like, well, Wolves have, you know, they've pushed Arsenal all the way here. And I remember thinking, I don't think they have,
yeah,
to be honest. Like, you know, it was a 1-0 domination, as you said, a really dominant performance, and one that I think we should have killed way before,
yes,
you know, we got that second goal. And I'm sure, you know, after the game, Mikel Arteta would have been, you know, very positive and very proud. But when he reviews it, I think he'll recognise that when you are that on top and when you have that many sort of promising positions in opposition territory, you've got to make them pay, because as dominant as Arsenal were, it only would take one moment,
yeah,
one set piece, one mistake, and then suddenly it's 1-1, you know?
Yeah, for sure. But look, I think Arsenal set the tone really early on in this game. Like in the first minute, Havertz, I think he might have like won an aerial or won a tackle or something like that, and he got us up the pitch and ended up taking a shot. I think he hooked it straight at the goalkeeper, maybe, you know, a little bit either side of him, and that goes in. It's a brilliant start for Arsenal. But I think that did set the tone for the way we wanted to play, and it suggested that the players were, like, I'm not going to, up for it seems fatuous, you know what I mean? Of course they were. There's a lot still to play for, but you could understand maybe if it took them a little while to get into their stride after a European away game. How many times have we seen it in the past where a team that plays away in Europe has a fairly indifferent first half and sort of only really comes to light in the second, or come to life in the second half because, you know, they've warmed up, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I think Arsenal, from the very first minute, were completely up for this one, made chances. Like you say, probably should have done more. I think Trossard said afterwards we should have scored more goals. You know, Rice had a couple of goes, didn't he, from the edge of the box. One where I don't think it quite sat for him, and then the other one where he put it just wide. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we were causing Wolves problems all the way through that first half.
I think we were. I think we were. And this was a Wolves side, you know, shorn of a couple of good players. I mean, I think Cunha has been a really dangerous player for them for much of the season. They didn't have him, so that played into our hands a little bit. I think you're right to pick out Havertz, who helped set the tone early on. You think about the amount of minutes he's played recently, and yet he still looks relatively fresh, relatively sharp. I think it's pretty impressive. He's quite an impressive athlete, I think, in that respect. But I was reassured by what I saw early on. I saw a zip in Arsenal's play. I saw a degree of focus and determination. And of course, you know, you expect that from a team in a title race. But given everything that had come before, I think everyone could understand fearing that, you know, that might slip a little bit. But whatever Mikel Arteta had said to them, whatever he'd done with them over the last few days, clearly got heads and minds fully focused. I remember, those two Rice shots. Then there was an instance where Saka and Odegaard had the ball in a promising position in the box but couldn't quite get the shot away. There was a Trossard chance. Do you remember where he sort of missed his kick?
Yeah.
On a cutback, similar position to the one against Aston Villa, actually.
Yeah.
And made no contact at all. And then with half an hour gone, there's a big moment in the game because Wolves go up the other end of the pitch and very nearly make it 1-0.
Yeah, I was looking at the stats after the game, and I think Wolves had something like 0.14 XG, which isn't a lot. But when you look at this chance, it feels, you know, like XG doesn't do it justice, if that makes sense. It doesn't really take into account how close we were to conceding there, because it was a ball that Kivior misjudged. I think it was the second one, actually. There was one a little bit earlier where could have been Hwang who went through into the box and we got back and defended. This time he sort of let it bounce. It hit his face and João Gomes ran into the box. The shot is from a very tight angle, but I think you just only need to look at the reaction of the Wolves player here to understand how close that was to being a goal. Raya's reactions are unbelievably quick. Because sometimes, like I'm thinking about that Trossard chance against Villa, where, okay, Emi Martinez sticks a leg out because, you know, that's just what you do as a goalkeeper, but it's more about the miss than it being a brilliant save. In this situation, the speed with which Raya gets his hands up to just deflect that ball onto the post and away is amazing, really. And the reaction of Gomez tells you, like, he thought that was going in. He thought that was going to be a goal. And it's an amazing save from David Raya.
Yeah, and such an important one as well. You know, how many times have we seen Bukayo Saka go through in that sort of position and lash one into the roof of the net? I think when the ball is struck at that pace, although the angle is tight, it's very difficult for a goalkeeper who's effectively kind of going backwards in order to save it, to actually keep that one out. It's a really excellent save and one that, you know, changes the course of the match. It was a significant error from Kivior, who obviously had come back into the starting lineup as part of the rotation.
It's the sort of error that Zinchenko would get absolutely destroyed for.
That's true, yeah. I'm sure there'd be lots of tweets around saying, I never want to see this guy play for my club again and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, I texted you about Kivior and I said, I think he's struggling again a bit here. But I have to say, there were two things that crossed my mind. It was like, okay, he's had a couple of moments in this first half, which, you know, aren't great. But I was wondering about what kind of decision Mikel Arteta might make at halftime. Could he, and I don't think he could, by the way, even if he'd wanted to, I don't think he could have taken Kivior off. Because, you know, having come off at halftime in a couple of games, I think it would have been just too damaging for Kivior to take him off at halftime again. And I'm not necessarily sure that his performance merited that. I know that was a mistake and it was almost punished by Wolves. But I have to say, I thought he had a really, really good second half in this game. I thought he was defensively secure. He won a lot of aerials, won his aerial duels, won tackles. Made a couple of clearances. Didn't allow that first half to get under his skin in any way. And I'm not sure he was like massively tested in any way. But I do think it was a promising second half, considering you know, what's happened in a couple of games recently where he has been taken off. I think the manager made a decision there, and it paid off in that second half, because I think he was good.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a credit to him that he sort of steadied the ship, as it were. And I guess what we're sort of learning about Kivior potentially is that he's an option at left back. Maybe he's not an option you can use in all games. Maybe some of the elite games where you come up against the very best wingers are going to be beyond him in that area of the pitch. But maybe Wolves away is the kind of game where he can play there and be all right. But yeah, I'm glad that he came through the second half relatively unscathed, because that was obviously a scary moment.
Yes, it was. But that was basically Wolves' only chance of the game.
Yes, and I think a point Mikel Arteta has been making over the last few weeks, and I think one that has some merit, is, you know, mistakes happen actually in every game. You know, this is a game where we come away with a clean sheet. We're all praising, you know, the defence and David Raya. Wasn't it another dominating masterclass? But we very nearly suffered from one mistake in that first half. And Arteta's been making the point that what's been happening to Arsenal recently is that those mistakes have been punished pretty ruthlessly. And I think that's probably true. Maybe your luck changes a bit here. You know, we don't get punished to the max, and it gives us a platform from which we can go on and win.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, we probably won't circle back around too much to the defensive side. Although, like I mentioned, Kivior, I think he was good in second half. And I think, you know, Ben White, I don't know where he gets the energy. I think Saliba and Gabriel were really impressive again. I also think that Raya, despite the fact he had little to do in that second half, was decisive and showed a lot of calm and good hands when he needed to. And I think that was, you know, part of what helped keep us secure in that second half.
Yeah, I think he's got such clean handling when he comes off his line and collects the ball. And, you know, there's a psychological impact to a goalkeeper doing that, I think, on both teams. I think it's really disheartening for the attacking side when you swing in a cross and a goalie just comes and plucks it away. And I think for defence as well, it's very, very reassuring, isn't it? It just gives you that degree of confidence, and it gives you time. It gives you a moment to collect yourselves, to reset tactically. It's such an important thing. And I think, yeah, he's done that very well all season. But I think I agree, at Molineux, away game, night game, crowd who, you know, chasing a point there, I think he did really well.
Okay, staying with the first half, should Wolves have been down to 10 men?
I think so, yeah. I do think so. I watched it. I mean, I had lots of screaming nieces and nephews around me at the time, but was there much of a review on it? Did you get the impression that VAR looked at it properly?
I don't know, because sometimes you see a tackle in real time and you think, oh, fuck, that's not good. And then you see a replay and it's maybe not quite as bad as you thought it was. I saw that in real time and thought, oh, that's not good. And then when I saw the replay, it was worse than I thought it might have been. I think what happened was he played on, didn't he? He let play go on. Arsenal had the ball.
Rice was booked, right?
Because I think we had it. Havertz was still down. Wolves got possession back, and Rice made, you know, a foul to stop the game, as much to sort of allow for Havertz to get some treatment as anything else. I think he was very frustrated by the yellow card in that situation. Kilman ultimately got booked, despite the fact the ref had played advantage. There wasn't a great deal of talk on the commentary about VAR looking at this, but I think that is absolutely a red card. Like, I could not excuse an Arsenal player if they made that challenge. And I think Kilman is extremely lucky, and Wolves are extremely lucky not to be down to 10 men.
Yeah, and I guess the other person who's lucky in this is Kai Havertz.
Well, yeah, because
he didn't get more hurt.
Well, yeah, when you look at it, this is what makes it a red card for me, is that it is his standing foot. It's his foot that's planted in the ground. Mm. And I think there is a huge slice of good fortune that as Kilman makes contact on his standing leg, he hasn't been more badly hurt, because it's the potential for serious injury there is extremely high. And we've seen some red cards this season where, let's say, a player has gone for the ball, misjudged it, maybe got a little bit of the ball. There was one, was it Curtis Jones for Liverpool, was one I'm thinking of, where he got a little bit of the ball but followed through and it catches the guy high on the leg. You know, so in spite of the fact that he got the ball or got some of the ball, it's the consequence of the tackle is seen as dangerous, therefore it's a red card. In this instance, Kilman doesn't get any of the ball. He's high on the sort of just upper ankle, I guess you would say. You know, ankle shin, that's where he catches him first time. And it is his standing leg. And I think as VAR reviewed that, they should have taken into account the potential for serious injury there. And that's why, for me, that should have been a red card.
Yeah. And not only did we not get the red card, we also got a yellow from the turnover with Rice making that foul. But in fairness, that was the right foul to make. And I applauded it, because I think there was a bit of frustration in there at what had just happened with Kilman and Havertz, but also it killed a counterattack.
Yeah.
It was quite important. But yeah, that was quite frustrating. I agree with you that that is a red card challenge. And I was surprised that in a kind of VAR era, you know, we know how VAR likes to intervene. Anyone who saw the FA Cup semi-final again, between Manchester United and Coventry will know all about that. I was surprised they didn't intervene in that instance.
Yes, me too. But then who knows when or why they're going to make decisions, you know? One week it's one thing, one week it's another. And maybe we'll come back around to that in part two, because there might be a question or two about some of the weekend's goings-on. The other thing in the first half, of course, was, well, a goal by Leandro Trossard. And I don't think you can say it's not deliberate, but does he mean to do exactly that? I'm not sure.
What did he say afterwards? I've not seen it.
Hang on. Sorry.
I assume, like any good pro, he claimed that he absolutely meant it.
Like Saka against Chelsea all those seasons ago. Let me see. Did he mean it? He said, I knew I had a small amount of time to hit the ball. And at the moment I see the ball came in front of me, I had to use my toe as well to get it in and on target. And it went in really nice. Obviously top bins, so it's a really great goal. That's what Trossard said afterwards. You know, that well-known Belgian phrase, top bins. I do think that the way he strikes the ball is a consequence of how the ball came to him. I think there's been a lot of discussion about Gabriel Jesus. Yeah. And, you know, lack of goals, and maybe in this game there were elements of what he did that were frustrating. But I do think he does very well here in the opposition box. It's a cross from Havertz. Jesus uses his strength very well, holds off the defender. Perhaps a touch of good fortune in that it I don't think it's a layoff per se to Trossard. It just sort of ends up rolling in his direction on the basis of what Jesus has done. And Trossard, I think he does mean to slice it, but it looks like he sort of whiffs at it a little bit as well.
Well, I think it's like you said, he takes kind of the only shot that he can, I think, with the ball traveling to him. It's relatively under his feet. He's got no real time to get it out. So he has a poke at it, and yeah, it works a treat. I don't think it's a total fluke, but I would say most footballers, when they're hitting a shot, they're not always knowing exactly where it's going to end up. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes you're putting your foot through something and trying to make good contact and hoping for the best. And in this instance, you're poking your toe at something. And yeah, there's a postage stamp in the top corner where if it goes in, great. But ultimately, you know, the point of contact on the ball makes such a big difference to the trajectory. Mm. You know, how much is any shot exactly meant to end up exactly where it ends up?
That's fair. That's fair,
But I think he does really well to get a shot off in that situation, and to get a shot off, you know, that ends up in the top corner. That's a real bonus. So, you know, I think he would have been a bit annoyed with himself because he sort of whiffed at the ball with that one that was cut across goal a few minutes earlier. But yeah, he made the difference here. And what did you make of Wolves? They fancied a, they wanted a free kick, didn't they, for Jesus in the box?
No, absolutely not. No way.
No, I thought it was more a penalty than a free kick, to be honest with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it could easily have been. I just think if you're a 6 foot four central defender or whoever it was, certainly much bigger than Jesus, if Jesus is using his strength in the box to hold you off, I'm looking at that as weak defending. Not a foul. Yeah. Not a foul.
And as I recall, I think that goal came obviously at a brilliant time right before half time. And, and I remember feeling maybe kind of around the Havertz incident, that last 10 minutes of the first half, that we'd slightly lost our way or maybe just lost our grip on the game ever so slightly. So it couldn't have been more perfect for us to score in that moment. And yeah, gave me, you know, restored some feelings of comfort to me.
Yeah, for sure. And like sometimes when you've had a week like we've had, you need a moment like that. You need a goal to go in the way that goal went in because he could have, you know, that shot could have sailed over. It could have gone 10 feet wide. I think sometimes you just need a bit of good fortune. I'm not saying it was entirely good fortune, but, you know, I suspect 9 times out of 10, that ball does not go into the top corner the way it did, you know?
Yeah. Just to come back to my point about the shooting, like, I know that these guys are pros, and so I think there is this assumption that, you know, when they take a shot, they're always aiming for the top corner and that's how they find it. And sometimes that is true, but I don't think – I remember Jamie Redknapp talking about free kicks, and he had a really good reputation as a free kick taker in the Premier League. And I remember him saying on an interview, he was like, I just aim for the goal. Like I just aim for the, aim to get it over the wall and the general area of the goal. And he ended up scoring a load of free kicks. But, you know, that question of intent is really difficult to pin down. And so I think we've got to give Trossard his dues. He got the shot away, and that's in a crowded penalty area.
Sure.
That is really the challenge.
Yeah, and like you say, a really, really good time for the goal to go in because it just sort of settled our nerves a little bit. In the second half, I don't know that there were like millions of chances for Arsenal in that second half, although we did have, I'm just going to double check here, 16 attempts on goal in the second half.
Yeah.
And were there any that were absolutely, oh my God, we've got to score there, we've got to score there, we've got to score there? I'm not 100% sure that there was anything like super clear cut, was there?
No, I mean, it's funny because I take notes through the game, right? And start of the second half, I wrote, started well, Havertz volley. And then I didn't write down any specific moments, but 74 minutes, I've just written, should be two up. And I think what that's about is that we had a lot of really promising positions where, you know, we were at the edge of their box. We had Saka and Odegaard on the ball, trying little combinations, White overlapping. And I think it's always the shots you don't take as well as the shots you do. And I think there were a couple of moments where things got a little elaborate or we didn't maybe find the clinical pass, you know, the final pass, the final action. But given the territory and given the way we were dominating the game, we should have killed it. And that'll be, I reckon that kind of 20, 25 minutes after half time, that's probably what Mikel will be looking back on and thinking, you know, what could we have done better? How can, or talking to the players and saying, what decisions could we have made in possession to take this game out of sight for Wolves?
Like, I didn't feel a lot of danger from Wolves, but obviously, as we've said, that 1-0 scoreline can change very quickly and you go from, you know, taking 3 points to dropping 2 points. And that sense of jeopardy, I think, ran all the way through the second half, as long as you don't score that goal. And I was looking at it and I was looking at certain players and thinking, man, he looks tired. He looks tired. And then you're looking at him 10 minutes later and going, he looks exhausted. Like, can I talk about Martin Odegaard for a second? Because I don't think this was his best game for Arsenal by any means. And from the start, I saw a player who didn't have that energy that he usually has, you know, to close down the center halves, to lead the press. He did it, but he did it in a different way than he usually does it. Like, he was playing within himself a little bit, you might say, but also did he have the legs? And there was a point in the second half where I was going, oh, he is absolutely out on his feet. You know, we need to maybe think about bringing someone else on here. What does it say to you that, okay, A, we didn't. Mikel Arteta didn't make that change. And I guess you could say something similar, maybe to a certain extent, of Bukayo Saka as well, who, you know, got another 90 minutes under his belt and potentially could have come off, because you're looking at him and thinking he definitely looks a bit tired as well. What's it say to you that we didn't make any changes with those two in particular? And also the fact that come the end of the game, in the 90th minute, you know, as it's going into injury time, Saka bursts into life and beats a few men in the box and almost cracks a shot on target. And Martin Odegaard, albeit with a touch of good fortune, is there to pop up with the goal that seals the game and secures the 3 points for us.
Well, it says rather a lot, I think. I think it tells us a lot about Mikel Arteta's faith in those players and his lack of faith in certain others. You know, Odegaard and Havertz, for me, the amount of minutes they've played recently has been extraordinary. But I think the fact that Odegaard keeps playing minute after minute, game after game, kind of tells us as much about, I mean, to pick on him, but it tells us as much about what Arteta thinks of Fabio Vieira at this point in time,
yeah,
as it does about Martin Odegaard. And we spoke about that a lot after Bayern, you know, the trust in quite a narrow section of the squad. And I think those players we've mentioned, Saka, Odegaard, Havertz perhaps, just particularly demonstrate that, because there aren't necessarily alternatives that Arteta has a great deal of faith in at this point in time.
I think it also says a lot about those players as well and their ability to dig deep. And when Arteta talks about having to play every 3 days, if you're a top player at a top club, you've got to play at a high level every 3 days. And look, there's good and bad to that as a concept, right? That there is only so far you can push the human body. And I think it is really important when we think about next season that we do have credible alternatives for game states like this, where you can bring somebody on for Odegaard, where you can bring somebody on for Saka. But the way that they dug deep into their reserves to contribute, and I was looking, you know, I thought it was quite interesting afterwards. I was looking at Saka after the game, and everyone has, you know, worries about him and worries about how much he plays. And I was just looking at a guy who was really, really happy to have played 90 minutes, to be on the winning side. And he looked great at the end. And of course, you've won a game and you're happy and everything else. But, you know, I do wonder sometimes if we over-index our own or project too many of our own fears onto the players that they don't necessarily feel themselves. I'm sure they're tired, and I'm sure at this point in the season the legs do feel a bit heavy, and nobody's arguing against that. But, you know, I looked at him and thought, he looks like he's just played, you know, 20 minutes of a training game is how happy he looked. Yeah. But, you know, that's anecdotal.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, you know, one, speaking of tiredness and fatigue, you know, a player I think that's applied to in the last few games has been Declan Rice, who, you know, to my mind, as far as I see it, has just looked a fraction short the kind of physically awesome specimen he has been for the majority of the season. But with that said, I thought in the final 10 minutes against Wolves, he just found another gear. I don't know if it was Thomas Partey coming on and in there next to him, but it was like Super Mario when he gets a star, you know, and suddenly he's just like running around the pitch everywhere, making blocks, winning tackles, you know, regaining possession. It was like once the finishing line was in sight, It's quite rare that you see a player sort of visibly dig a deeper, but he did. And I found it astonishing because I've been watching a lot of games and thinking, he's not quite right. He's not quite there. So to find those reserves of energy that he did in that last 10 minutes really took me.
Yeah, I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was absolutely superb in those final stages. And when you look at the game that he had overall, 4 shots, 2 shots on target, 5 key passes, 4 tackles. You know, his defensive contribution, I mean, that's more tackles than anybody else. Gabriel made 3. You know, he really did epitomize what Mikel Arteta says about what he wants and needs from his big players. He was absolutely amazing in the final stages of this game. He was involved in the goal, wasn't he? Took the ball on, drove towards the box. Havertz to Odegaard. I think Odegaard was looking for Havertz again. But it rebounded to him. He squeezed it in with his left foot between the goalkeeper and the near post.
Yeah, nice little finish actually on the rebound, I think. Quite, you know, tight angle. But Ward really for, you know, an extraordinary effort in the game. You know, everyone could finally breathe out and relax. And it's a big win for us, huge win. You know, and hopefully one that can give us a second wind, because the next 7 days of football is pretty big as well, right? 2 London derbies. The finishing line is in sight. We know in all likelihood what we need to do. They're all going to have to dig deep, like Declan Rice did, like Ben White did, like Bukayo Saka did. They're all going to have to do that if we're to get over the line in first place.
Yeah, and of course, you know, that's a win that put us back on top of the Premier League. Which, you know,
maybe it's not always so bad after all.
Yeah, but I mean, this is what I mean. It sort of felt strange that, you know, we're in this position. It's a bit at odds with, you look at the table and then you sort of feel the sentiment, if that makes sense. And understandably, after 2 defeats and a disappointing exit in the Champions League, you know, the mood is low. But, you know, here we are, top of the table again. And we had to, you know, we really had to respond. And I think there is a huge amount of credit. A 2-0 win away at Wolves, a Wolves side that, you know, do have a lot of injuries, not just Cunha, but I think Ait Nouri only came on for a few minutes and he's been really, really good for them. Pedro Neto, of course, is not there. Experienced defender, Craig Dawson isn't there. You know, so
their form has suffered as well.
Yeah, and they're not at their best. And I don't think a 2-0 win with a goal late in the first half, late in the second half, is going to go down in the annals of Arsenal history as one of the great performances. But I do think in the context of the week that we've had and what we needed to do, the players deserve a lot of credit for the way that they carried out the job at hand, because it's not really at this point of the season about how you do it. It's about making sure that you just do it, that you get the 3 points. And going back to what I was saying at the start, I think with a bit more daylight between the result and the performance, it's a more impressive performance perhaps than initially given credit for.
I think it is. I think it's in line with what we've done for most of the season. And it's interesting, you know, with it being the 20-year anniversary, there've been a lot of allusions and comparisons made with the Invincibles this year. And obviously, you know, this team are not the Invincibles. They've lost 5 league games for a start. But they had a week in their season where it felt like everything was going wrong for them. You know, they went out the FA Cup to Manchester United. They went out of the Champions League. I don't need to tell anybody who that was against and what happened there. And it felt like it was all imploding, you know, and massive game against Liverpool, we're losing at half-time, turned it around and won. And as we all remember, went on to win the league unbeaten until the end of the season. This obviously is not quite as big as a home game against Liverpool, but I think in terms of the kind of psychological trajectory we were on, the kind of downward spiral we were potentially looking at, I think pulling out a win at Molineux and you know, giving ourselves a platform to push on for the remainder of the season is, in, you know, if we win the league, we may look back on it as being almost as important. Less dramatic, yes, but maybe as important.
Okay, so big win. Puts us back on track, puts us back on top of the table. And of course, there is a big game tomorrow evening against Chelsea. Before we go into part two, I suppose we might as well just look very quickly at some of the other stuff that's happened this weekend. We had a lot of requests for hashtag Ten Hag out. I'm not going there, guys. We still have to play Manchester United away. And I am not tempting fate in that way. But did you have a chance to look at any of the FA Cup semi-final yesterday and the way that, that we were denied one of the funniest things that football would ever have served up by a very, very marginal offside late in that half? And Manchester United's ability to implode is quite something.
Yeah, well, we... were watching the game, and I think we turned it off, probably got like quite a lot of people at 3-0.
Yeah.
And then we heard it was back to 3-3. And I watched the extra time and the penalties. And yeah, let me tell you, when Coventry got what we thought was the winner, there was some real jubilant scenes in the living room here, and quite a lot of frightened toddlers at all the noise. But yeah, it's obviously taken away from us. I remember, do you know what? I remember we were jumping up and down, and like there's a mixture of different fans here of different clubs, but I think we're all united in not liking United. And I remember catching sight of my brother, who was not jumping up and down, not particularly celebrating, and just sort of muttering under his breath, going like, offside, check that. And I remember thinking, A, how sad that moment no longer has the kind of, you know, jubilant, carefree joy that it once did, that moment of a last-minute winner in a, you know, huge cup shock. And also, obviously, secondly, how disappointing that it did prove to be marginally offside and was overturned, you know. But I've long spoken about my sadness about the, you know, the sort of those moments always being subject to a review and what it takes away. Yeah. But in this case in particular, because United were the victim, I was even more aggrieved.
Yeah, yeah. It was like when you look at the replay and when you look at the lines that are drawn, it might be technically the right decision. And if it were us on the other end of it, you know, we'd say, well, you know, that's what it is. So, you know, offside is offside or it's not offside. And if it's offside, it's offside. And look, you know, but when you're denied the ability to laugh at Manchester United in that way, you know, yeah, it's very, very disappointing. And frankly,
I also think, is that the spirit of offside? I mean, people may disagree on this, but what's the offside rule designed for? You know, it's designed to stop you hanging around the goal 10 yards behind the opposition defence. I don't think the law is designed to stop someone who's effectively level with somebody running through on goal.
Yeah.
It feels to me at that point, the law isn't really serving its purpose, but maybe this is all just because I wanted to see Man U suffer. I don't know.
Well, that's it. That's it. You know, the benefit, I suppose, or the benefit we were told was going to go to the attacking player in situations like this, and I'm not sure that's the case. I also don't think the fact that when they look at these VAR decisions, like, are they using cameras from the 1980s? They always seem like super pixelated compared to the, you know, the sort of HD, ultra HD coverage that we get as a rule now. I don't really understand why these VAR images are such low quality and low resolution. I don't know if it's different kind of cameras or what, but it is what it is, I guess.
The biggest question for me, and the one that people seem to accept – is the point of contact with the ball. Mm. Like, I don't know how they determine precise point that the ball leaves the player's foot. And it feels like that's the quickest part of the check. They just sort of, you know, press pause roughly when they think the pass is played. But surely the precision of that moment has a huge impact on the ultimate offside decision. But there's no sort of close-up technology to determine that. So it does feel quite arbitrary to me anyway.
Anyway, look, the thing is, as disappointing as it was not to see Manchester United suffer the most hilarious defeat of all time.
Well, listen, ultimately, Andrew, the reason we're not doing Ten Hag out is because surely we are Ten Hag in.
For now. For now. That is for sure.
Forever. Mean, long may he reign in my eyes. I mean, but like you, I have this nagging fear of, you know, everyone is waltzing through this Manchester United midfield to get chances. Coventry had the ball in the net 4 times and hit the bar. You know, we all know that Arsenal at their best should take this United team apart. And yet we all have that nagging fear that we will be the exception, you know, who struggle. So until we've got that win, then I think we should hold off the Ten Hag crowing.
I think that's absolutely the right thing to do. Okay, we are going to take a little break here. Stand by for part 2, in which an announcement is coming. A very exciting announcement. So we'll be back with your questions and more, including that announcement, in part 2, right after this.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part 2 of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arseblog, also on the Arseblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arseblog member on Patreon. And this week, above all weeks, the benefits of being an Arseblog member on Patreon are many and varied. Not only do you get all the extra content that's coming today, for example, the 30, looking at all the Premier League action with Phil and Chelsea preview pod with Lewis, we are going to put on sale tickets for our end of season live podcast with our friends at the Arsenal Vision podcast. They're going on sale tomorrow, exclusively for Patreon members. There will be some general sale tickets available on Wednesday, but if you want to get on board and you want to have the best chance of getting tickets, you can sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/arseblog. Not only do you get an extra chance or a better chance at these tickets, this month every single penny from our Patreon is going to be donated to UNICEF to help kids all around the world who are afflicted by war, famine, disease, and other terrible things. So it's going to a great cause. You get great content, and the money goes to a great cause this month. Patreon.com/arsebog. And, James, do you want to tell people where this live event is? Because it's not at Union Chapel this time. We've had to do it a little bit closer to you.
Yes. We're in an even bigger venue, somewhat absurdly, but we're at Alexandra Palace, which is incredibly exciting for me because it's about a 10-minute walk from my flat. So on convenience alone, I am delighted. But it is a genuinely beautiful venue. Hope to see lots of you there. History suggests these tickets go quite quickly.
Yes.
And we might be, you never know, we might be on the eve of a title win.
Fingers crossed.
Who knows? Oh, that would be a hell of a weekend, if so.
Oh, my goodness. It really would. So if you want to join us at Ali Pali, it is Ali Pali Theatre, by the way, not the gigantic one. So if you're a fan of darts, you don't have to come dressed as a panda or something like that. I mean, if you want to.
You don't have to. Yeah, I will be. Of course.
Your furry lifestyle is exposed at last.
Absolutely, yeah. But, and afterwards, we'll go back to mine for a drink. All 800 of us,
perfect.
Whatever it is.
Perfect. You just get a nice jug of punch for everybody, take a little cup, and
exactly.
we'll have a great time together. That doesn't sound at all sinister and like a cult, does it? Drink the punch. Drink James's special punch.
We're not hosting this event to Carl. I know it may seem like that, but that's not our intention.
All right, let's do some questions. And we've got a couple like this from the Discord. The Partier is over, who says, do you have any thoughts on why we've become less prolific from set pieces? We've gone from scoring nearly one in every game to having none since late February, early March. We don't look threatening from them at all now. Given tiring legs, it seems like this is a strength we should be leaning into at this stage of the season. While Martin on the Discord as well says, goals from set pieces have dried up. Is that because the opposition are onto it? Or because we're switching up things to avoid that and it's not quite the same?
Great question. I mean, the most boring answer would be it's kind of plain old variance. You know, we were getting the rubber, the green, and now we're not. I suspect as well, the point about the opposition carries some here. Like, I think so much was talked about Arsenal set pieces on mainstream media that you must imagine that the level of detail that opposition analysts have gone into on it is enormous. Maybe it's just the effect of people catching up with what we're doing. I also think time is a factor. You know, I saw Mikel Arteta was asked pieces in a press conference recently, and he was asked, you know, how many hours spend honing those routines? And he sort of laughed and said, well, we don't have hours. You know, how long is a training session for a Premier League footballer? Hour and a half, 2 hours tops? Set piece coach on a good day gets 10 minutes at the end of the session to work on something. Now, when your schedule is compressed, when you're playing every 3 to 5 days and one of those days is traveling and one in recovery and then you've got to travel back and all this and that, I just wonder if we don't have the time to apply the practice to set pieces quite as much anymore. So maybe, you know, the degree to which we were innovating and trying new routines dropped off a little bit because the sheer time, you know, just isn't available.
That makes sense. It's probably all of those things. And, you know, when a team is particularly strong in a certain area, I do think the opposition coaches, managers, analysts pay more attention to that. And set pieces might be one of them. You know, I think there are probably, when it comes to corners and free kicks, we maybe saw a little bit of a routine when Odegaard pretended to take a free kick and it sort of unsettled the Wolves' back line and then reset and put the ball in again as a way of trying to sort of destabilize the way they were defending. But I think there are probably a finite number of routines and things you can do from set pieces over the course of a season. You know, do we line up at the back post? Do we go for the near post? Do we start in the middle and two go front, two go back? Like, how much more is there that you can do in terms of innovation or player movement or delivery from specific areas of the pitch? So I think it might just be a case that we've not quite run out of steam in that regard, but, you know, there's only so much we can come up with over the course of one season. You'll have the summer to think about some new things to do. And I think your point about variance is probably it. Like, we haven't scored from a corner for a while. It feels like we're overdue one. So when Gabriel scores the first goal of our game against Chelsea tomorrow night with a thumping header from the corner, all will be right with the world again.
Yeah. I mean, the real answer is that I bought Gabriel into my fantasy football team. That's the reason it stopped happening.
For fuck's sake.
I know. Where? Sorry, everyone.
Jesus Christ.
What about this question? I guess it almost sounds like something from the Stats podcast, but it's from Wise Marklar. Oh, no, sorry. Sorry, Wise Marklar. That isn't the question I wanted. I'll come back to you. It's from Non-Flying Dutchman. And it says, goodly morning, gents. Which statement is more true? Arteta needs to do a better job of rotating the squad, or Arsenal need better rotation players for Arteta to use?
I am more inclined to go with the second statement there than the first.
Interesting.
I think he could do a better job with some of the players that he has. But as we said in the first half, like when we talked about Martin Odegaard and Bukayo Saka being tired, like there's no reason really why, if you had, or if the manager had faith in the options available to him on the bench, that he wouldn't have taken Odegaard and maybe Saka off and put somebody else on for the last 20 minutes to give you some fresh legs or give you something a little bit different. So it seems clear that he doesn't necessarily trust the options that he has available to him. Therefore, I think the options that he has available to him need to be improved. But I think you made a very interesting point on the last one, that for the most part, in fact, maybe entirely, this is a squad of Mikel Arteta's creation. Is that the right word?
Construction. Yeah,
construction, where they did sanction 35 million for Fabio Vieira. They did give a new deal to Reece Nelson. They did give a new deal to Eddie Nketiah. And I think there are probably other reasons and layers to those, you know, which we've talked about, you know, about maybe the protecting the value or the fact that, you know, these are guys who could have left for free and who might, if things go well this summer, generate some revenue. Like it was easier to renew Reece Nelson than buy another winger, if that's what it was. But, you know, this is a squad of his construction. It feels like players like Vieira, like Nelson, like Nketiah, like Smith Rowe, even Thomas Partey, are peripheral to his, not to his team, but to a team that he thinks can get the job done in basically any game. Not really dependent on the opposition. I think we saw with the team he picked against Luton that I think he took into account the fact we were at home, and I think he took into account the quality of the opposition, which is to take nothing away from Luton. But beyond that, he just isn't rotating, and he isn't comfortable rotating players who could definitely use a little more rest because they've given a lot. So I go with the second part of that more than the first. What about you?
I think I differ, actually. I think he needs to do a better job rotating players. And I think we're talking about a lot of these players now as like, well, yeah, you know, obviously they're not good enough or whatever it might be. But part of me feels like, is that because they're not being used, and when they do get on, they haven't played for 6 weeks and they don't play particularly well, and therefore we're sat here at the end of April and their value and our estimation of them has tanked based on what it was a year ago, for example. Like I'm thinking of guys like Smith Rowe or Partey, and I know injuries are a problem. But I feel like there was more to get out of some of these players this season. I would include, on a talent level, I'd include Fabio Vieira in that as well. There may be one or two more. But I think there was more to be wrung from them. That said, I think it is also true that we need better players, because ultimately it's Arteta who is staying. and we all want him to stay, and he is the man in charge. And so summer by summer, window by window, we will have to find players who match his estimation and his sort of changing, evolving feelings about them. I mean, I would love to ask him the question, why was it that in the first half of the season, you know, Eddie Nketiah started a load of games for us and played a load of minutes, and then second half of the season, barely got a kick? Like, I'm not saying it's the wrong decision, but I just would love to understand that logic. And I feel like with Arteta, it sometimes feels like Edu, I wonder if Edu sometimes feels like, bloody hell, I've got to keep pace with this guy changing his mind about players. and I'm sure, and I think it's sort of a theme at Arsenal where it's like we keep improving more and more quickly. And so there's more and more need for a turnover in players. But, you know, Mikel's going to get another load of new players this summer. And I really want to see him embrace the rotation element, if he can. Like, I think it's an important step in his managerial development. And personally, I think he probably could have done a bit more of it this season.
Maybe we're not taking into account the fact that some players who might have played a lot, or maybe more, like Vieira, like Partey, have been out because of injury and surgery. Yeah. And, you know, Tomiyasu is another one. We had a question.
Timber, of course, as well.
Yeah, Timber, yeah. We had a question, should we sell Tomiyasu? He's a good player, can play in multiple positions, but he's hardly ever available. Like, I don't think we should sell him. We've obviously just renewed his contract, so that doesn't look like an option to me. But I understand why people are frustrated by his continued absences or his inability to allow the manager to rotate in certain positions. Like, if Tomiyasu had been fully fit all season, you know, I'm sure he would have played some games at right back, and it might have allowed Mikel Arteta to rotate Ben White here and there. And I also think you have to acknowledge that everyone will say we don't have the ability to properly rest Bukayo Saka, right? I think most people would agree with that. Is that because we don't have a player who can reach his level? I think it probably is. We've got functional players who can come in and do a job. Like, what was the game? Was Reece Nelson, he started against Luton, right?
Yes, he did, yeah.
So he had a very, what I would call, functional performance in that game, where it felt like he was instructed to come in, do a job, keep the ball moving, don't try anything risky. And I think he did that. You know, he was fine in that regard in terms of the instructions that he was given. But did he offer anything as an attacking force in that game? No. So on the one hand, you can say Arteta should do more and rotate more. But I think the Saka situation is one which highlights the fact that we don't have a player who can come in and do what Saka does, which is difficult when he is as good as he is. I think we all accept that, right? When you've got a player who is that good, it's very difficult to find a replacement who's happy to sit on the bench for a lot of the season. But that, I think, plays into the reason why, when it came to those two statements, I was leaning more towards the latter than the former. So
yeah, I think probably the truth is, you know, a little bit of both, and you know, people will have different perceptions of kind of how those are apportioned. I do think, you know, we look at the transfer window and we're like, you know, we want starters, right? We want a starting number nine, or we want a starting left eight. I actually think the second layer of the squad needs real attention. You know, I mean, players like Trossard and Jorginho have played a lot of games this season, but I think we need more players like that who are, you know, not our top bracket earners, not guys who expect to be picked every single week, but can absolutely rotate in and do a really good job. That's probably easier said than done to find guys like that. And I think it's interesting that in this squad, those are two of the older players, maybe two of the players who felt that Arsenal was probably the best move they could get at this, that point in their career.
Sure.
Maybe that will feed into the strategy for how you find those players. But I also think the other side of it is that managers, by their nature, are kind of hoarders. You know, there's a hoarding mentality. I don't want to let that guy go because I might need him.
Mm.
You know, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, sorry, you know, you've got to stay. I might need you. Eddie, I might need you. Reese, I might need you. I think Mikel, we know how ruthless he can be. And I think in order to sort of fund this improvement of the second layer of the squad, he's going to have to let go of a few. Mm. And I think his selections over the last few months tell us that he is preparing to do that.
Yes, I think that's true. What about this? This is a question from Rory Fleming on Twitter, who's at Rory Flem. He says, what is the missing piece to the puzzle for next season in terms of a progression as a team? Last summer, it was very clear we needed a combative and most importantly, fit number six, and we signed Rice. This summer, things seem much clearer. Is a new striker the priority? Is it another signing in the eight position to allow Havertz to play solely up top, or another fullback to finally put to bed our left-back woes?
Well, maybe all of the above. So what's the question? Which is the most striking need?
Yeah, the missing piece of the puzzle. Like, what's the...
I think... God, that's a really good question. I think the reason it's difficult to answer is that the puzzle is... And I whether I would have said this in the wake of the defeats to Villa and Bayern, I don't know if I would have had that clarity of perspective. But the puzzle is not in bad shape. You know, it's very nearly there. I mean, I'd argue we've got a puzzle. I'd argue we've got quite a complete picture, but it's just not the best team in the world. And they're the team that we're up against, along with Liverpool, to win the league. So what do we need to get there? If I had to say, I think I would pick a truly elite goal scorer. Just because... I think you take any team and you plonk a 30-goal striker into it and they go up a level. Yeah, I think we need those other positions too. I just think that that's the one that could really change our world, as somebody once said about a different striker. What yes. do you think?
I tend to agree with you that despite the fact we scored more goals than anybody else... It does feel like that sort of ruthless finisher would be kind of a game changer for us. Mm. And if you can continue to supplement and augment the goals that that guy scores, then you put yourself in a better position. You know, you think about certain games this season, and this goes back to maybe what we were talking about after the Bayern game, the need for just a little bit of individualism, that guy who's got just something unpredictable and unexpected. And I'm not saying that I think Arsenal are predictable, but I think we are a team that operates in patterns and structures that if you analyze them well enough as the opposition, you can probably go a long way to stifling us and stopping us, you know? So having that little bit of unpredictability, I think, will come from a forward more than any other position. But I hope it's also a summer where we pay a little bit more attention to midfield. I have a feeling that if Arteta has his way, or the kind of player that Arteta likes would be like a younger Jorginho to add to the mix... You know, whether that's Zubimendi or somebody else, I'm not 100% sure. But I think in terms of the profile of player that Arteta would like, given how well or how much he's leaned on Jorginho and Jorginho's skill set in the biggest games this season, a younger version of that, I think, is probably what we're going to get more than, let's say, a left eight.
Right, yeah. Interesting. And as for the striker thing, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if you could add Erling Haaland to this team, I think they'd be really dangerous. But who's out there that's at that level? You know, I think it is difficult to discern who that might be. I know there's a few names in the mix, but do any of them necessarily convince us being a game changer for us? I'm not so sure. Let me ask this question.
Okay.
It's from Gabby Scores That. And they say, "Goodly morning, gents. I see popular accounts have been giving Martinelli stick lately, even saying he's culpable for the Villa and Bayern goals. Would you sell Martinelli to Newcastle, Villa or Liverpool? Don't know why those clubs specifically, if he's not benefiting from the current system." More broadly, kind of where are you at with Martinelli at the moment?
I would like to see maybe a little bit more from him. I feel like he hasn't been at the same level as last season. I also think there are reasons for that. I think, you know, the left side is more detached. Tim wrote a really good piece for the blog, his column last week about the left side. So people can check that out. I'll put it in the show notes. I do think there is work needed to make our left side as cohesive in attack as the right side. And I think Martinelli is the guy who's been out there a lot. He does feel a little detached at times. Whereas there are combinations on the other side, they're not quite there as much on the left-hand side for Martinelli. He's also only 22. And I do think as well there is there's a lot of room for improvement still, a lot of potential there. So, no, I wouldn't sell him to Villa or Liverpool or Newcastle. I would hang on to him. I think he is close to the bottom of our list of things we need to sort out, albeit, as I said, I would like to see a little bit more from him in terms of end product, because it isn't quite where it needs to be. And I think we talked about, you know, a player who might help us get over the line in the title race, somebody who could chip in with goals and assists. And I think he was my pick. And he hasn't quite done as much as you would have liked, I think.
Yeah, I actually was thinking back to last summer, and I think we got our sort of annual question of who do we expect to have like a breakout, standout season. And I think you picked Gabriel Martinelli and I picked Gabriel Jesus. So that went well.
Yeah.
But I saw a stat recently. I think between them, they've got something like 16 goals. You know, if you had told me that those two players would get a total of 16 goals and that we'd get to a Champions League quarterfinal and be top at the end of April, I would have been very surprised. I think we're right to have expected more from both those players this season. And I have defended Martinelli actually all season long for the reasons you outlined, the left-hand side, which is still being changed up game by game almost. You know, we don't know who's going to play left back. We don't know who's going to play left eight. I say now we don't know who's going to play left wing really, because Trossard's doing well and Jesus has played out there. Martinelli's had an injury. So it's very much up in the air. But I do think this has been a stalled season in his development. And I think he needs to improve to keep his place in this Arsenal side, because, you know, the way we're structured at the moment without that elite goal scorer, that position he's playing, we actually need more productivity from it. Whether it's quite his fault or not,
yeah,
we do need that.
I think that's fair. You know, I mean, it's remarkable to me that Bukayo Saka gets any kind of criticism at all. I don't really understand it.
Yeah.
But in 31 Premier League games, he has 14 goals and 8 assists, you know, which is 20... I can't do maths anymore. 22?
Two.
Oh, God. 22 goal contributions in 31 games, whereas Martinelli has 6 goals and 4 assists in 30 appearances. So it's like a 1 in 3. So 10 goal contributions in 30 games. And I think he is capable of doing more and doing better. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater with regards to him in any way yet. You know, he can do better, but he is only 22. And there are issues and there are mitigating factors as well. So let's not, you know, I think we've got other things to solve than Gabriel Martinelli. So,
yeah, I think that's fair.
What about this one from Peter Sharp, who's at Sharpie Peter? He says, have you ever known a time like this where the feeling among the fans is that the season is over, but we're top of the league? If we could beat Chelsea and Tottenham this week, do you think the feeling around the fan base will change, or will it only change if City drop points?
I was thinking about this. Have I ever known a time? I don't think so, quite like this, where we're top of the league and I think optimism is relatively scarce,
yeah,
given that, given what a good position that is. But I do recall sort of being in the sort of proper title race era when we were duking it out with United season on season. I do remember periods where we would be in what was ostensibly a fantastic position, but because we'd drawn a game instead of won it, or they'd won a hard away match or whatever, you did feel quite despondent. I do think it's kind of a function of when you are at the very sharp end of the competition. It's like, what does success look like for Arsenal from this Premier League season? Well, kind of the title, and anything else is sort of underwhelming. And there are only two or three teams in the entire league that feeling applies to. But yeah, it's striking how quickly we've adjusted and adapted. Our sights have raised, haven't they? Very, very quickly. Our expectation level has raised very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, it's a big ask. I think if we win these two games this week, we've still got a brilliant, brilliant chance of winning the title. I think this is the proper make or break week, to be honest. I know there have been some results of late that haven't been brilliant. And when you open the door for Manchester City, usually they walk right through it and slam it in your face. That's what they do. And that is why the mood is low. You know, why the optimism isn't there, coupled with a Champions League exit as well. But if we can win these two London derbies, I think we've got a brilliant chance, because it's not impossible to me that Manchester City dropped some points. What did you make of Guardiola's comments after the FA Cup game, where he was talking about, you know, it's impossible, it's a disgrace, asking too much of the players, you know, why couldn't we play on Sunday like the others? You know, and in part, the reason why they couldn't play on Sunday was because we're playing Chelsea on Tuesday, and that's been scheduled by the broadcaster. So Chelsea couldn't play on Sunday and then play on Tuesday. You know, I get there's a bigger discussion to be had about the scheduling, player welfare, City, you know, they're in the Champions League, and this is a consequence of being in the Champions League, is that you're going to have to play every 3 days. You are going to be tired. You're going to have to use your squad, blah, blah, blah. I get it. Game goes to extra time. It's even more fatiguing and everything else. I just thought it was really interesting, particularly in the light of Guardiola making public the fact that some of his players asked to be taken off against Real Madrid. The fact that he then doubled down on that with criticism of the scheduling and how tired the players were. And I think there was a party line, wasn't there? Because I saw Bernardo Silva talking about this a bit as well. He was very critical of the fact that they had to play on Saturday, even though, you know, we played on Wednesday. We also had to play on Saturday. I just wonder about City going public and Pep going public with that kind of stuff, whether it's just a slight crack in the machine, you know, which is why I think if we can win these two games, it puts just a bit of pressure on them. And, you know, I think we've got a chance.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, obviously, you know, win Tuesday night, we have a chance to go 3 points clear at the top of the table, 4 points clear of City. They then go to Brighton on Thursday, which is that their hardest remaining fixture? I think it possibly is.
Well, they have. I mean, yes, obviously on paper it is, but they've got a terrible record against low-level Tottenham Hotspur. So.
Yeah, sorry. So those are the two games I'm sure all Arsenal fans are looking at and hoping for something. So I'd say this week is really crucially important, isn't it? If we can beat Chelsea, which, by the way, I don't think will be anything like as straightforward as it might have been a few months ago. I think while they are certainly an imperfect team and there's infighting and squabbling over penalty kicks and all sorts of hilarious things, their form has improved, and in Cole Palmer, they've got a really dangerous forward, especially for the penalty spot. Yeah. So I really hope we can get past Chelsea. If we do, then yeah, all eyes on City at Brighton. And if they drop any points there, I think that is so key. I think even if we keep winning our games, there'll be a kind of resigned feeling of, yeah, but City are invincible, aren't they? I think that's sort of ingrained in us now. I think we need to see, I think the biggest lift this Arsenal squad could get would be seeing City falter. I just think it would be massive. So come on, Brighton, do us a favour.
Yeah, but we can only do what we can do. As Arteta keeps saying, we can only control what we do. And I think, you know, putting in the performance and winning the game against Chelsea, however we win it, is huge. Puts a bit of pressure on City then for their next game. And similarly, you know, Sunday in the North London Derby, form goes out the window, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's one of those where we just have to get it across the line. And I have to say, I think if we do it, if we win these two games, I would feel confident that this season could end really well for us. But let's see. Let's see.
Yeah. We didn't beat either of those teams in the reverse fixtures, did we? I think it was 2-2-2 draws.
Mm.
So, yeah, be really nice to get a win over them.
We owe them. Okay, look, I'm going to just do one more because, you know, you've got to get back to your family in Australia there. Adam Turks says, goodly morning, gents. I've been bemused by all the pundit aghastness at the Nottingham Forest tweet. It can't be seen in isolation. From the moment they appointed Clattenburg, something like this was surely inevitable. They were gearing up for battle. Is this the first shot in the PGMOL wars, or is it going to blow over? And just to give people context, if they're not aware, Nottingham Forest were aggrieved that they didn't get three penalties, or that three penalty decisions were not given in their favour in the game against Everton at the weekend. I think they probably have a case for at least one of them. I think all three are like, well, yeah, you've seen them given, but I think the third one in particular is a stonewall penalty. They sent out a tweet, three extremely poor decisions, three penalties not given, which we simply cannot accept. We warned PGMOL that the VAR is a Luton fan before the game, but they didn't change him. Our patience has been tested multiple times. Nottingham Forest Football Club will now consider its options. I mean, what do you think about a football club reacting in that way after a game?
Well, didn't Arsenal do it after the Newcastle game?
I think it was slightly different in that Mikel Arteta reacted, was then charged, and Arsenal gave their backing to what Mikel Arteta said rather than issuing a statement like this. Is that not, am I remembering that right? Or
I think the chronology might be slightly different. I think the charge came after the statement, but you might be right. I don't honestly remember. I must admit, I've not seen the game, so I can't comment on the penalty instance in question. I don't know what I think, Andrew. I don't know. My instinct, I don't particularly... I'd like to believe that these conversations could be had behind closed doors, but evidently Forest feel they've tried that approach and it's not succeeded. So as far as I can tell, I'm really not across this, I've got to be clear, but as far as I can tell, Forest have come in for a lot of criticism for this, right?
And yeah.
A lot of people saying it's a joke and, you know, what's Plattenberg's job? Why is he doing it? He should resign. But just from the outside, I feel like maybe they've got a point. Like, if the VAR was the Luton fan and that was something they called attention to and it wasn't attended to, and they've tried to have that conversation in private and they've not, you know, got anywhere with it, I sort of think fair enough in a way. What do you think?
I don't know. I think there's probably a line. I'm all for, as you know, I'm all for managers being able to speak and being able to be honest, because ultimately we're dealing with adults and grown men. And I think, you know, the inclination by the authorities in the game to charge somebody with disrepute or bring the game into disrepute because they have a strong opinion on what happened in a game of football. You know, if that opinion is honestly held and constructively delivered, then I really don't like the idea of charging managers. I just wonder about, you know, where can that lead us if football clubs as institutions make accusations? You know, the accusation here is that he's a Luton fan, therefore, he didn't give decisions to us because he wants to give Luton a better chance of avoiding relegation. You know, you know, if that's the case, you know, I do wonder if an Everton win wasn't much good for Luton either. You know, but I think it's probably more about incompetence, as we keep saying, with referees and refereeing standards. Competence or incompetence and lack of communication from the PGMOL, because my gut feeling on this, you know, I've watched the highlights. I think all three are decisions where you've definitely seen a penalty given in all three, right? But I don't think only the third one for me is absolutely a really, really, really terrible decision. Because I think you can, not excuse, but you can understand why maybe penalties weren't given in the first two. I have a feeling that behind the scenes, there has been an edict from Howard Webb or whoever that the threshold to give a penalty for physical contact has been risen. You know, there's got to be more contact. There's got to be more, obviously, a foul. Whereas I think the world we existed in before was there's contact in the box, therefore it's a penalty, right? How many times did we hear that said? I think that's kind of where we were. And I think there's been a change where they're looking for more contact to justify awarding a penalty, which I suppose is probably not a bad thing because not every contact in the box should be a penalty. But we're flying blind a little bit because that wasn't made public. Or it wasn't sort of, you know, the way at the start of the season they made everybody know that if you kick the ball away, this is a new rule, you're going to get a yellow card. Sure. We haven't heard that. There hasn't been specifics from PGMOL to say, actually, we're going to raise the threshold for giving a penalty because we think too many penalties are being given for soft things. But ultimately, you know, penalties are given for half nothing. You can get clattered in the box by a goalkeeper and not get a penalty. So this inconsistency is I suppose, what is the most frustrating thing. And I would say it's that more than any kind of conspiracy. And I think once football clubs go down the road of accusing officials of bias or being prejudiced against them, I don't know.
This is so funny to me, Andrew. Because isn't that what Arsenal fans have spent most of the season doing?
Is it, though?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what's funny about this is that I feel like you're saying what I said after Arsenal made the statement about the Newcastle.
Maybe so.
Like I feel like I would echo your sentiments 100%. But when that goal went in at Newcastle, that is not what we were saying.
But isn't there a difference between fans and football
clubs
as institutions?
Yeah, but I didn't agree with the Arsenal statement at the time. I felt that was unnecessary. And I think I said it was dangerous. And again, I got hammered for it. But I do think that it's not great. But I just don't want to be a hypocrite. That's come out from Arsenal. And so if that's the world we live in, if Forest want to put a statement out, then I guess they can. Fair enough. But I don't think it's constructive or good. And I do think that alluding to personal biases in officiating is something that is dangerous, because I don't know where that ends. I just don't know where that ends.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's from somewhere. Everybody's got a mate who's a someone fan. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, where do we stop? But yeah, I think you're right. But until we, it's so hard to ever get anywhere with it because we're all so fucking biased.
Yeah, I think the distinction I would make about what Arsenal's statement was, Arteta was talking about the standard of officiating, or maybe the process, yeah, or what have you, rather than making an accusation of bias or prejudice by one official.
Of course.
Specifically,
and he was cleared
against
on
the
that basis,
club.
Right?
Yeah.
He was cleared on that basis.
Disgracia, you know?
Yeah, it was a disgracia, indeed. But yeah, it's a really complicated one because I think there is a distinction, you're right, between Arsenal and Forest. Forest is more personal, it's more loaded, it's more suggestive of corruption. But maybe I'm wrong, but I felt like that was sort of implicit in some of what Arteta said. I felt that he chose his words very carefully to protect himself, but that, and I think fan discourse, I know you say fans are different, but like, I think we need to be, well, we don't need to do anything, but I'd like it if fans could be more, what's the word? Slightly more grown up about referee. I do wish that sometimes. Mm.
What do you think when Nottingham Forest say Nottingham Forest will now consider its options? What are the options?
Well, there are no options.
Well, that's it. You know?
What are they going to do? Withdraw from the league?
Or sue? Or, you know, take a legal challenge? Or go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport? Like,
well, that I mean, I guess that is the route, right?
Yeah.
That's the only way this can... That's the only thing they can possibly mean. And that in itself, I mean, it's bad enough, all these points deductions and the arbitration process around them and what follows and appeals and not knowing, you know, what the league standings are until everything's finally ratified. Imagine if we've got to litigate every refereeing decision.
Yeah, yeah. It's a Pandora's box, you know.
The problem is, and I always come back to the same thing, which is that, like, you're never going to get objective. You're never going to get truly objective officiating in a human game. It's just never going to happen. But you can get better officiating, and I think we all agree on that.
That is the thing, you know, that the discussions and debates about constructive ways to improve refereeing standards, I think, are important. And that's the point I've made all the way through, that it is important, you know, not to gatekeep managers who, if they are making a constructive point, you know, I think all this will do is Premier League and PGMOL will circle the wagons. Nottingham Forest will get fined probably quite considerably for this. And I don't know that, you know, having someone like Mark Clattenburg write an article for the Daily Mail is particularly helpful either.
I didn't know that happened. I mean,
yeah, he wrote an article saying these three decisions were, you know, really wrong. I haven't read it completely, but it's basically backing Forrest's position because, well, he's employed by Nottingham Forest now.
But I suppose my question to you would be, like, I know one of the words you're very big on with PGMOL is accountability.
Yeah.
But would Forrest not just say, and this is playing devil's advocate here, but would they not say, well, we are trying to make them accountable for these bad decisions?
That could be their justification for this, sure. But I'm not sure that this is the right way to do it. Then again, I don't know how, if you have made efforts behind the scenes, and that's something Mikel Arteta has alluded to as well, that they have, you know, spoken behind the scenes and haven't been necessarily happy with the feedback they've got, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Because I remember Mikel in press conferences being like, well, believe me, we've had these conversations many times.
Yeah.
And that's where I suppose I have some sympathy with Forrest, because, again, we don't know, but if you're having these chats every week and the same thing keeps happening, at some point you have to escalate it. Is this the right way to do it? Probably not. But I can understand their frustration, because I felt it myself at times this season.
Mm.
But it's such a problem now. I really think that almost cosmetically, almost like for appearances, I think PGMOL needs to be like rebooted in the biggest possible way.
100%.
Because I think fan and club faith in it is at an all-time low.
Yeah, agree. And it's not a rebrand it needs. It's a rejigging.
Knock it down and start again. Honestly, because I think otherwise, now who's going to be the next club after Forest? Do you know what I mean? Like, now it's just going to be the integrity of the whole organization is under constant scrutiny. That's what I mean about it being dangerous, because there's like a domino effect where it's like, well, if we don't have any faith in the laws of the game being applied, then what are we doing it?
Yeah.
So I hope that, I doubt it will happen, but we spoke about it a week ago. I would be, if I was the Premier League, chucking a ton of money into starting again, getting the best people from all over the world, selling it to the fans and saying, look, we're making this as good as it can possibly be. And I think only with that kind of fresh look at it do we stand a chance of avoiding this conversation every single week for the next however many years.
All right, well, let's hope we see that at some point. I don't really expect it. I'm not going to hold my breath.
I don't think it's going to happen at all.
I don't think it will either. But, you know, it is, again, this is why I think there does need to be constructive dialogue, because something does need to change. And I think pretty much every football fan would agree with that. Anyway, we have gone on too long. Please join us on Patreon later. We'll have the 30 recapping all the Premier League action. We'll have our Chelsea preview podcast. And of course, you get a chance tomorrow to buy tickets to our live event at the end of the season. It's patreon.com/arsblog. For now, take it easy, folks, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.